Welcome to the stream. I'm Femi Okay. The scale of our global climate emergency is so big that we're seeing climate change stories making headlines every day. But there's not so much news about remarkable creative climate action happening around the world to inspire and encourage us. So in today's special episode, we are joined by a former UN climate chief and guest to bring you the Good News Climate Action Show. My co-host for this show today is Christiana Figueres. She is a former executive secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and is co-founder of Global Optimism and also co-hosts the Outrage and Optimism podcast. I don't know how she has time to join us, but she has, and I thank you. Christiana, thank you so much for being here. When I was thinking about how do we do climate action better and communicate that better, I always think about you because you've coined a phrase which is stubborn optimism. Unpack that
well,
for us a little more.
Well, this is true. Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you very much, Femi, for asking me to join you today. Very exciting. And, you know, the message that you brought right at the beginning is so true. The fact is that we are having exponentially growing climate effects that are all very negative. And, however, at the same time, we have exponentially growing, encouraging initiatives that convey an excitement of a world.
Oh, yes.
That not just averts the worst of the climate crisis, which would be the minimum, but actually also helps to build a world that is safer, cleaner, more just, a much better world than the one that we're experiencing right now. So, Femi, thank you so much for this program. I'm very excited because today we're going to bring just a few stories that are meant to boost your confidence in what is already taking place and trigger your imagination for what can be. So Femi, what do we have?
I'm so excited just listening to you hype the show. All right. If you want to talk to Christiana, then one of the things that is really important for us to do is for us to let you know that YouTube is live. It is available right now. If you've got comments or questions for Christiana, you can put them into our comment section and be part of today's show. We're looking forward to it. All right, so can you imagine a world with no fossil fuels in it? Zero. So to get there, we need alternative forms of clean energy. Vitea Cohen is co-founder of the green hydrogen production company called Enapta. Welcome to the stream's Climate Action Optimism episode, Vitea. So good to have you. I suppose for most of our viewers, or many of them, they would want just a really quick and easy explanation for what green hydrogen is. I know you've never said this before. Can you tell us?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me today. It is a real pleasure to be able to tell you more about green hydrogen and Enapta. And so green hydrogen, as you just said, is an alternative fuel. It can replace our dirty molecules that we have today, coal, oil, and gas. And how do you make green hydrogen? Well, you have a device called an electrolyzer. Ours looks like a box, actually. It's about the size of a microwave. And what it does is that it uses electricity from solar and wind, for example, and splits water, H2O, into hydrogen and oxygen. And that's how you make green hydrogen. Simple, right? All you need is sun and water.
Christiana.
Well, the exciting thing, Vitea, so good to see you again. We've been together in the past. So good to see you again. And I just think that the exciting thing here is we have become, over the past few years, we've become used to having solar and wind directly producing energy. To the point where I think those what used to be called new renewable energies are by now traditional renewable energy. So what I think is so exciting about what you're doing, Vitea, is that you're building on that, right? You're building on that to produce an energy that is much more energy intensive than the original wind and solar, and that therefore can be much more powerful in displacing coal and gas in those sectors that are very energy intensive. You are definitely on the front lines of very important breakthroughs in energy. How do you see that we're going to break into those heretofore unbreakable sectors?
Yeah, I mean, you put it so well, right? Before we had green electricity, but we needed this green fuel. And so now being able to scale green hydrogen means that we can decarbonize those heavy emitting industries like the transportation sector or steel, cement, all these industrial processes. And so what you'll do is that you'll produce green hydrogen on site. And then if we're looking at the transportation sector, for example, let's just focus on aviation. What you'll do is that you'll have electrolyzers on site at the airport, and you will be producing green hydrogen, refueling it, and then it'll fly CO2 free. And it's the same process, right? If you want to make green hydrogen for steel, for example, again, you make your hydrogen on site and then you'll use it directly. So some use cases store the hydrogen, some use it directly. But what it does essentially is that it is reducing our CO2 emissions.
One of the things I love about you, Vitea, is that you understand the technology and you're able to explain the tech and break it down for people. But you're also a great storyteller. And it really is important that people understand what this kind of technology means for people down on the ground. So I know you brought some video with you. I'm going to share this with our audience just to wrap up with. So this is a village in Malaysia. Enapta have partnered with PESTEC, which is a local energy company. And this is how this village has been transformed. Take a look.
Sekarang dah kira ada elektrik kan? Ada elektrik, macam ada sukacita lah. Wah, elektrik ni orang guna pasang macam apa, radio dan juga televisyen dan juga masak nasi. Jadi ni, ing masa depan, ing muat mabik sangat-sangat lah, sangat sekolah, muat bor, muat supaya mai berjaya tentang sekolah ni.
Vitea, it's been such a pleasure sharing your work with our audience around the world. We wish you and Enapta every success in the future. So, Christiana, what I'm thinking about here is, when we're being optimistic, do we use the carrot or do we use the stick approach? And I think sometimes lawyers are the stick approach when we're trying to make change happen. What do you think?
Yes, and sometimes the stick is necessary, isn't it? So what Vitea has just proven is the importance of technology and pulling the technology of the future into the present, which is incredibly helpful. But in addition to technology, we also need grassroots movements. And where they have been incredibly successful is in the legal space, as you have mentioned, Femi. And perhaps the most famous and most successful story there is more or less 900 Dutch citizens who brought a case against their own government, arguing that the government was not protecting them duly from the ravages of climate change. And they stuck with it. They stuck with it for 4 years. They had this legal battle that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled that they were right, that their government was not protecting them against the ravages of climate change. And the Supreme Court forced the government to reduce 25% of emissions in a very short time. That has inspired other cases across Europe, in Canada, in New Zealand, in Colombia. And what it proves is that legal cases are also a very powerful instrument, but it also shows, Femi, the power of people. These are 900 Dutch citizens, just normal citizens, okay? These are not famous people. These are 900 citizens that were concerned about the impact. So what do we know, Femi, about grassroots movements? What do we know about community and the role that they play in climate action?
There's so much more power than you know you have until you harness it. Before we move on, Christiana, I'm going to bring in one more voice, and this is the voice of Dennis Van Berkel, who we spoke to a little bit earlier. He is a lawyer and he leads a group of lawyers that keep governments accountable. Let's hear about their work before we move on.
Governments have promised us for decades that they will do what is necessary in order to prevent dangerous climate change, but their actions simply don't add up. There's a huge gap between what they say must be done, hold temperatures below 1.5 degrees, and what they're actually doing. And courts provide a unique forum to scrutinize the statements of governments, to scrutinize whether what governments are saying with regards to their actions on climate change actually add up and are sufficient in order to cumulatively protect us against all those dangerous impacts of climate change.
When activism merges with science, it's a very powerful formula, as we are about to find out. Dr. Tallulah Oni is an urban epidemiologist who leads the Citizens for Clean Air campaign in Nigeria, Ghana and South Africa. Hello, Tolu. So good to have you. Tolu, I'm going to make a black girl blush because when I first heard about you, I was told, she's dynamic, she's connecting, she's brilliant. How do you even live up to that? What is it that you, your mission is? What are you trying to do that takes you to at least three different countries on the African continent and getting citizen scientists to understand what's happening to their environment?
Thanks, Femi. I could say the same thing about you. What drives me is the fact that we have the youngest continent globally. Half of people on the African continent are 19 or under. When we talk about health, we should be talking about ways to keep young people healthy. Now, air pollution is particularly something that animates me because it both is an important exposure that is important for health, but it's also very low-hanging fruit in terms of climate action, because we know a lot of the air pollutants are also greenhouse gases contributing to global warming. So I started seeing that, you know, from a public health perspective, we understand the importance of public space and how to get people moving and be physically active for their health. But there are also these air pollution risks. And I started looking around and realizing we weren't really measuring it in these cities. At the same time, we saw this this incredible passion and commitment to environmental justice and climate action in the cities. And I thought, what if we could get and harness this energy from the majority demographic on the continent to be part of the solution, because we can't change what we don't measure. So what we're doing is exactly that. We are looking at the ways that we can emphasize the crucial role that young people can and should play in designing and developing and shaping the urban environments that we live in for both health and climate resilience.
Christiana.
Well, what I love about this, Tola, I've always thought that it is so important to humanize global climate change. And honestly, it's very difficult for people to understand that these fossil fuels emit gases that have a global impact. But it's much easier to understand that the very same fossil fuels also emit local pollutants that are affecting our lungs, especially in cities, as you say. And so the health and climate overlap is so critical because it makes it so much more understandable. I totally love that. Air quality really makes the pollution from fossil fuels so immediate. And I'm assuming, Tolu, but please tell us, that this has actually really energized young people, mothers who are concerned about the lungs of their children, who are concerned about the health of that their children are growing up with. This is something that goes absolutely to the very bottom of our own concern about our own health and the health of our children, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And Femi mentioned earlier about citizen science. So we had one of the really animating aspects of this initiative is we had young people that were recruited through public selection, and they designed running routes and they ran through these cities with air quality monitors and with an app that captured photos, videos, audio, showing sources of polluted air, sources of clean air. And they really rallied. So each of the run leaders rallied and recruited a pack to run with them. And they used that opportunity to share why it's so important to them. And one of the things that we did was then they looked at the data they collected, and they used that to design interventions. So that they review the data they collected and said, well, what are the things that we're seeing here in our city? How does the air quality differ? How does the quality of public space differ within and between cities? And they've used that to design an advocacy and activism campaign that we're doing in the run-up to COP27. So they've been doing runs again in these cities, in Accra, in Lagos, in Cape Town, but also beyond those cities. And on the 10th of November, which is when COP27 is happening in Egypt, the 10th of November is also Youth Day, and it's the science theme day. And so what we really want to do is push, and we invite everyone to join this is to push the agenda to show that clean air is really critical for both health and climate, and young people play a critical role in designing and shaping that future for a healthy climate resilient space.
Oh, my goodness. Tolly, thank you so much for being on our Climate Optimism show. You embodied what we were trying to do, what we're trying to get over, and we wish you every success with all of your campaigns and your work. Thank you, Tolu. But as I say thank you to Tolu, I want to bring in another young climate activist from the founder of I Lead Climate Action Initiative. This is what she told us a few hours ago, Christiana. And I know you spend a lot of time with young climate activists. What do you make of what Adenike has to say?
As a passionate or advocacy for climate education, we get to find out that once you don't know that a problem exists, you can't solve it. So the first approach towards awareness is education. Educating people, young people, then expanding the horizon for climate justice.
Well, she's so right. Educating people is so important because it's the only way that we're going to get mobilization. Now, I think the difficulty around that, Femi, is to educate young people and also not so young people about the reality of climate change, which includes two pillars: the threat of climate change, but as we're discussing here also, the opportunity of addressing climate change. And unfortunately, most education is only on the impacts and the disasters of climate change. And we have not, I still have yet to see serious programs that also bring the opportunities. For example, we've just seen, you know, Tolu has just talked to us about air quality monitors. What would happen if we have air quality monitors on every single cell phone in the world? We would have much more education about air quality and much more awareness about where air quality is being threatened and what we can do about it. So we have to have both the opportunity of addressing climate change as well as, of course, the threats and the impacts.
Christiana, I know you said a little bit earlier, you were talking to us about the power that people have, the power of community. And when I spoke to Kiddus a little bit earlier on, he really embodied what it is that we're able to do, because sometimes we feel that the climate crisis is overwhelming. But this is what Kiddus has to say about that. Here he is.
We know that every single piece of major legislation that's passed in U.S. history has been due to movement building. Whether we're talking about the Civil Rights Acts of the 50s or 60s, or marriage equality, they would not have happened without people being in the streets over the course of years pressuring their politicians to do so. So when you look at the recent climate bill that's passed, the first one in U.S. history, we know that's the work of groups like Sunrise Movement pressuring officials to deliver for them.
Our final segment today is about community and how it lies at the heart of climate action. In Puerto Rico, the community-based organization Caso Pueblo is transforming the Central Mountains. Caso Pueblo's executive director, Arturo Masaldea, joins us now. Arturo, it is so great to have you, because what you do and what you're doing, what the community is doing, is community-based, sustainable programs that really show us how do we live in the future, because you're already doing it in the present. When I think about the kind of programs that you're doing, what one would you want to share with our global audience, the one that's going to blow their minds that they're going to tell all their friends about tomorrow?
We have to integrate the agenda. We have been protecting the land, fighting for water security, and doing that requires to confront the fossil fuel economy. And in 1999, we established our first solar system. And the idea is to democratize energy generation at the point of consumption, in which people can benefit directly from energy security. We have our main installation, Casa Pueblo, the radio station, the transmission tower. We built a solar cinema. We have been helping hundreds of houses that has chronic disease, people that requires energy security for medical purposes. We have done the barbershop and the pharmacy and the bakery and the lechonera and other places looking for economic activation. And as we're moving forward, transforming our energy landscape, we're becoming a reference for local development. Thinking in people, thinking in engagement, education, and protecting our natural resources as well, in a way that we are also better prepared to confront climate change in the Caribbean.
Cristiana.
Bueno, Arturo, hola, qué gusto de conocerte. So wonderful to be here with you. One piece, Arturo, that you didn't speak to that I would love to invite you to is the resilience of renewable resources, how they are so much more resilient to the impacts of these amazing storms that the Caribbean and so many of the other areas of the world are having. And please tell us, how long was Puerto Rico without electricity, except Casa Pueblo, because you had solar? It's just such a fantastic story.
After Hurricane Maria, in Adjuntas, almost 4 months in the urban areas, the rural communities over 1 year without power. The central part of the island, where most of the poverty regions are located, it was the last 30% in which energy was restored. So building energy resilience, we were able to reopen Casa Pueblo the day after. And the consequences of these hurricanes are very bad. But the reality is, it is that the aftermath is what transform a hurricane experience into a human disaster. A lot of failures from the public and private utility, and yet Casa Pueblo was producing power. We reopened, we became an energy oasis. People came here to recharge their equipment, dialysis, therapy, respiratory machines. The radio station was on. We were able to deploy and respond, rebound right away, because we were energy secure. That's what we have been fighting for, not only for Casa Pueblo, but for the whole community and the different elements of our community to also enjoy the benefits of producing power, clean energy at the point of consumption. And I'm so happy to see that there's other technologies, other options in the pipeline that will help strengthen configurations like the one we have been building in Adjuntas.
Arturo, I am so enjoying watching you because you have a solar swagger about you. It's like when the rest of Puerto Rico, they came to us to help them because we had the energy. We were able to help them. There's so much pride in what you're doing. Congratulations. Thank you for continuing to be a model for all of us watching around the world. And I'm going to take a little bit of your solar swagger and take it through the rest of my week. Arturo, thank you so much. Really appreciate you. Cristiana, before we go, on YouTube, people are having a conversation about the climate crisis. It is always a debate. One of our viewers is asking, what about the point of no return? Or does stubborn optimism say that we don't even use that phrase and we just get on and roll our sleeves up?
Well, we don't know, right? We don't know the point if we're going to get to the point of no return. Scientists have been telling us that we're getting horrendously close to going over thresholds that are going to be irreversible. But that is exactly the reason why we have to double down. That is exactly the reason why we need these kinds of stories that we've heard today multiplied times a million, 3 million, 10 million, because we don't want to get to the point of no return. And here's the thing. We can stop this. We can actually reverse the trend of greenhouse gas emissions, which is currently still rising. We can reverse that trend to a decreasing trend of greenhouse gas emissions and thereby avert the worst of the climate crisis. But, Femi, scientists have been abundantly clear that we have to do that by 2030. So, yes, there are many wonderful stories, yes, and we need to go exponential with them, okay, because we are getting very, very close to the deadline.
All right. Cristiana Figueres, it's been such a pleasure being your co-host on the Climate Optimism Show. I really appreciate you. Have a look here on my laptop. These are two places I really want you to have a look at. Global optimism. Look at what Cristiana and her team, the work they are doing, and also an incredible podcast, Outrage and Optimism podcast. It will keep you entertained and educate you and inspire you as well. Thanks for watching today's show. I'll see you next time. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.